This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Twenty-five years ago, on June 26, 2000, President Bill Clinton greeted dignitaries and scientists from all over the world in the East Room of the White House to make a major announcement.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome.
A detailed map of humanity's genetic blueprint, over 20,000 genes made up of over 3 billion base pairs, our DNA, the fundamental building blocks that carry the code for how our bodies develop and function.
Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind. The moment we are here to witness was brought about through brilliant and painstaking work of scientists all over the world, including many men and women here today.
Painstaking was an understatement. The man standing next to President Clinton on this momentous day could attest to that. Francis Collins, the scientist in charge of the Human Genome Project.
You have to recognize that the genome is kind of the center of the center of everything you want to know about biology and medicine.
Francis had been a supporter of the project from the start. When he first heard about it in the 1980s, he was a researcher at the University of Michigan looking for genetic causes of illnesses. He had spent 5 grueling years hunting down the gene responsible for cystic fibrosis, which he discovered in 1989.
But to imagine doing this again for the hundreds or thousands of diseases that also would benefit from that kind of discovery just seemed completely unimaginable, unless you had a basic foundation of understanding of the human genome, the 3 billion letters of the human DNA code.
So when the Human Genome Project was officially launched, Francis was eager to jump on board.
I was a big fan. I wanted to see that happen. I applied for a genome center at the University of Michigan, received that award, and thought, okay, I can be part of this.
But of course, that's only the beginning of the story.
I didn't expect to be asked to lead the whole thing.
He was tapped to fill the very big shoes of James Watson, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist who had first proposed the double helix structure of DNA along with Francis Crick. Watson had resigned 2 years into the project. Francis Collins knew that leading the Human Genome Project would be a major challenge. This was an international collaboration, which meant managing thousands of scientists around the world, not just their work, but their egos, not to mention billions of dollars in funding. And it was a big commitment. The project was scheduled to take 15 years, ending in 2005 with the unveiling of the completed human genome. He wasn't sure if he was up for it.
Went and did the interview and toured the NIH, and then I said, no, this is not my dream of what my life is going to be. I'm having a great time in Ann Arbor doing research. But then I had to think about it for a few months. How do you walk away from what, if it happens to succeed, is potentially the most significant research ever done in life sciences? And you're just going to say it's not a convenient time?
He changed his mind and started in April of 1993.
And it was a wild ride from that day forward.
A wild ride, to say the least, filled with unexpected twists and turns that made it necessary to step on the gas pedal in a big way. When the Human Genome Project was launched, the initial goal was to be finished in 2005. So how did we get to this draft announcement in the year 2000, 5 years earlier? In his remarks, Bill Clinton compared the DNA sequencing to the maps created by the Lewis and Clark expedition into the American West.
It was a map that defined the contours and forever expanded the frontiers of our continent and our imagination.
But maybe a comparison to the space race would have been more accurate, because what had happened behind the scenes leading up to this day was a nerve-wracking, cutthroat competition to get to the finish line, a competition where every minute counted and the future of scientific inquiry was at stake. Liz Tung picks up the story from here.
When Lauren Linton agreed to sign on to the Human Genome Project in October of 1997, she had no idea what she was getting herself into.
So I came in and did not know that by February of that pilot year, so 4 months later, we were due to be cut because we were not doing very well.
Lauren had been recruited to lead the MIT Whitehead Institute Center, one of the three federal centers involved in the Human Genome Project. It was a major job, but Lauren was the right person to do it. She's a scientist, but unlike a lot of the project's other leaders, she wasn't an academic. She had cut her teeth in the competitive world of industry, having launched and led her own successful biotech company.
So I'd managed a lot of big projects. I'd managed them in industry. I'd managed budgets.
All skills that, as she soon discovered, would be crucial to saving the Whitehead Center. It was one of the biggest gene sequencing centers in the country. But by the fall of 97, they were on the chopping block. Costs were too high and output too low. So right away, Lauren pulled together a game plan.
So I quickly got in there and developed cost modeling, process modeling, took over a lot of the program management, did a lot of biological experiments. I had a R&D team to work on new methods for us that were automatable. By February, we had thoroughly improved those things and saved ourselves.
It should have been smooth sailing from there. But then, just a few months later, in May of 1998, something happened that shocked everyone involved. Something that upended all their plans. Something that could pose an existential threat to the Human Genome Project. And that something was Craig Venter. Craig was once called by CNN biology's bad boy. And when I talked with him on Zoom, he kind of looked the part. Think Captain Picard with a neatly trimmed silver beard and steely blue eyes. And you can tell right away that he is not the type to mince words.
The scientific community is not necessarily the most forward-thinking community. It's very conservative and very parochial.
Craig sees himself as more of an outsider, a maverick. But back in the 1990s, he was very much a part of the official scientific community. He'd spent almost a decade working at the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, where he made a name for himself by developing a faster technique for gene discovery. He left the NIH in 1992 to found the nonprofit Institute for Genomic Research, a pioneer in genomics that sequenced the first complete genome of a free living organism, a bacterium called Haemophilus influenzae. Craig was ambitious and brash, and of course, wanted to be involved in the Human Genome Project. His lab initially managed to snag a piece of the puzzle, sequencing chromosome 16. So he was part of the project's very large team. Until one day in May of 1998, according to Lauren, during a meeting with some of the project's lead scientists, he made a shocking announcement. Here's Lauren.
Craig came late, walked in, didn't even sit down, and announced that he'd be starting a company. And he'd leaving the federal project, and he would be doing the human genome on his own, and that we could go off and do the mouse, which is very upsetting to everybody at the table.
Craig's company, called Celera, had received $300 million in funding from a company that manufactured DNA sequencers, which meant they had plenty of money to invest in beating the Human Genome Project. The project's leaders were shell-shocked, not only at the perceived betrayal, but at the realization that the Human Genome Project, this international collaboration of scientists from around the world, working to make history, working to decode the blueprint of human life, could very well become nothing more than a footnote in the history of genomics. Even worse, they worried that the move could lead Congress to lose interest and defund the project. So most people working on the project were pretty upset.
And when Craig did this, they villainized him. How could he do this? He was on the federal effort, and now he's the enemy. I was actually not surprised he did it. To be honest with you, the project was ripe for a takeover.
Over the years, Craig had grown frustrated with the Human Genome Project. It was too slow, too cumbersome, too bureaucratic. But he had a solution, an approach to gene sequencing that he said was faster and more efficient. It was called shotgun sequencing. And from the beginning, Craig had been pushing hard to adopt it.
It was clear to me in 1995 that this was going to be the ideal method for sequencing the human genome, and Collins refused to fund it. They were absolutely certain it wouldn't work. It was never part of the discussion because it was almost like a government make work project.
So here it helps to understand a bit about how sequencing works. The human genome is enormous. It includes roughly 3 billion base pairs, which are the fundamental building blocks of DNA. Each pair makes up one of the rungs of the ladder in the double helix, represented by the letters A, T, C, and G. And each one of those billions of letters needed to be read. They're ordered decoded in order to sequence the genome. But it wasn't possible to sequence the whole genome all at once. It was too big. So instead, the Human Genome Project had decided they would break it into manageable chunks and use a process called mapping to create a framework for which chunk belonged where. Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, used an analogy to explain it.
Imagine that you're trying to put together the words of War and Peace,
Tolstoy's epic tale that spans well over 1,000 pages.
And you basically take the book and you put it through a shredder and you mix it all up. And then you try by looking at those letters to figure out what went next to what.
The mapping approach was like shredding a page at a time and then reassembling it, which, Francis says, was easier and less prone to mistakes.
Because you don't have so many options to get it wrong. Basically, the scaffold is like the one page at a time. You've already assembled stretches of DNA, in this case, in the order of 150,000 letters along, where you know those are all part of one piece of human DNA. And so if you try to reassemble that from shorter segments, you're pretty likely to get it right, because there's only a limited number of ways you can put it together. That's what the public project was doing.
So before any real sequencing could happen, they needed to build that scaffold, a slow and deliberate process. The project had plenty of mappers, too many, if you ask Craig.
The genome community was dominated totally by genetic mappers who weren't even interested in sequencing. They were just interested in trying to find genetic diseases by mapping.
Craig's approach, shotgun sequencing, skipped the mapping part. To use Francis's War and Peace analogy, it was like putting the entire novel through the shredder and then putting it back together, all at once instead of moving a page at a time. Craig felt like he had already shown that this could work. But Francis, among others, was not convinced.
People who knew a lot about the mathematics of genome assembly were deeply skeptical that approach could result in the kind of quality assembly of the human genome that we were promising to deliver. So it wasn't that his idea was rejected because it was coming from him. It was just an idea that the experts had already reached a very strong conclusion that this is not going to give the answer we need, at least not with the technology we have then.
So Craig broke off to do his own thing. And, always a forward thinker, he had a solution for the logistical challenges, designing an algorithm and executing it using a high-powered computer, one of the most powerful in the world, custom-made for his team, to assemble the pieces correctly. His goal was beyond ambitious, to finish the whole process as much as 5 years before the projected completion of the Human Genome Project. The reaction among the project's leaders was anger and panic. Here's Francis Collins.
Yeah, human nature, you're not going to be too excited about that. But I think it was really more about the notion of what's the ultimate outcome going to be? What's going to matter? Are we going to end up with a sequence that's highly accurate, the quality is really good, and we worried about the Celera approach not achieving that? And is it going to be accessible to everybody?
Francis mentions accessibility because not only was Celera going to run away with this big discovery and get the credit that went with it, there was something even bigger at stake, namely what Craig was planning to do with the completed genome. They'd heard that he wanted to patent it, which would mean that anyone doing research on, say, the gene that causes muscular dystrophy might have to pay Celera for the privilege. Here's Lauren Linton.
So if we did not want that genome patented and put into the patent office so that everybody doing research from that point on genes would have to take a license to it, we had to finish it in a year.
So Craig Venter and Solera had really thrown a wrench into the plans of the Human Genome Project, and members of the public project were feeling the pressure to speed up their timeline. Luckily, Lauren Linton, the director of the Whitehead Center, one of three federal centers involved in the Human Genome Project, had a plan. As part of her previous efforts to revamp the center, she had come up with a way to scale up their sequencing. Within a few months, they were moving 20 times faster than before. In the meantime, Lauren, who's something of a maverick herself, had been thinking about how the public project could compete with Solera. And so, at another meeting several months later, she presented their progress and then made a radical suggestion.
So I said, there's only one option here. We have to go to shotgun sequencing as well, which, you know, was an uproar.
Shotgun sequencing is the approach Craig Venter was using at Solera. If we go back to the War and Peace analogy, if you put the whole book through a shredder and try to put it back together, Craig was trying to sort out all the letters at once, while the public project was moving one page at a time, mapping out a basic structure of what belonged where. And Lauren noticed that the mapping step was really slowing them down.
If you know anything about building like an assembly line, you're looking for your impedances. Where are your bottlenecks? Because you need to remove them if you want the whole thing to be at a certain throughput. Well, mapping was the major impedance for the federal project.
Now that the Whitehead Center had ramped up its sequencing, they were moving faster than the mappers and had run out of pieces to sequence. At this rate, Lauren says, there was no way they could finish in a year. To have a snowball's chance in hell of beating Solera, they would need to adopt the same strategy as Solera. There was just one problem: assembly. Taking those millions of letters from War and Peace and putting them all back together. Computing power was one thing, but they would also need a program, an algorithm, to figure everything out. Despite that, under pressure from Solera, Francis Collins said yes. In December 1999, across the country at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a computer scientist named David Hausler received a call that would change his life and the history of genomics.
That conversation, yes, I remember that vividly.
It was one of the main leaders of the Human Genome Project, and he wanted to know if David would be interested in signing on to help the project find genes once the genome was assembled, meaning to comb through these endless strings of base pairs, the A's, C's, T's, and G's that make up our DNA, and figure out where specific genes are and what their function is. This is something David already had experience with. And in fact, Solera had already tried to recruit David, an invitation that, as exciting as it was, he ended up turning down.
I really didn't believe that it was appropriate to have the genome privatized, essentially, so that you would be charging a subscription to read the genetic heritage of the human species. That just sounded like a crass and very dangerous proposition to me, actually.
David was thrilled to join the public project. He knew he would need help, so he recruited a couple PhD students, including one named Jim Kent, who David knew as a programming genius.
Jim, quite the character. You could see pictures of him. He looks like something out of Middle Earth.
I'm not sure which Middle Earth characters David had in mind, but if I had to guess, I'd say Gandalf, or possibly a dwarf, on account of Jim's big beard and crown of curly, now silver hair. I talked with him over Zoom.
And let me just check. Ooh, too loud.
And his answers to my questions, much like his hair and beard, were sprawling and unruly. These days, Jim is retired, but in 1999, he was a 39-year-old PhD student making a career change. He had spent the last few years working in the nascent software industry, but he'd gotten bored with that and decided to go back to school to study biology.
I didn't really have a super clear idea career-wise what I was going to do.
But he did enjoy combining coding with biology. And so when David invited him to join the Human Genome Project, Jim said yes, so long as he could take 2 months off to finish his thesis. Over the Christmas holiday, David and Jim formulated a plan and got ready to begin gene finding. There was just one problem. In order to do their job, to identify specific genes and what they did, the genome had to already be assembled. And it seemed like the project wasn't even close to figuring out how they were going to do that. Here's David.
There was a lot of work to do, and I was being asked to join the project, but it wasn't really ready for the gene-finding step. And I saw a train wreck coming.
David actually went to visit one of the centers where a postdoc was working on the problem. She was clearly brilliant, David said.
But just one postdoc, which is, it seemed like a dangerous situation to me. So we actually started working on the assembly problem quietly.
It wasn't that they weren't allowed to work on the assembly problem. It was more a matter of diplomacy. They didn't want to step on anyone's toes. Plus, if they did it in secret, there wouldn't be anyone looking over their shoulders telling them how to approach the problem. As the spring of 1999 rolled around, the competition started heating up. The media had latched onto the story and was reporting feverishly on the race between the Human Genome Project and Celera. Francis Collins says the coverage was a double-edged sword.
On the one hand, it did cause people working on this to feel like, oh my gosh, we're in the hot lights of public scrutiny. On the other hand, it was great to see the public was actually interested in a project which had largely been ignored until then. It seemed like only when there was a race and when there was a personality issue involved, and that Craig Venter has a yacht and Francis Collins has a motorcycle, that it becomes something that the press wants to cover.
Craig Venter at Celera, however, remembers the coverage getting pretty ugly.
Watson called me Hitler. Francis Collins said we were doing the Mad Magazine version of the human genome. They just made constant public attacks.
Whatever the case, the media coverage meant that public pressure was mounting, and both sides were starting to feel it. To make things even more stressful for the public project, everyone could see how fast they were moving. That's because, in keeping with their philosophy of scientific openness and research for the public good, they were uploading all their DNA sequence information to the internet every 24 hours. Here's Francis.
We felt this was such a valuable contribution to understanding human biology and human medicine that it shouldn't sit anywhere unused for more than a day.
But it also meant that Celera was able to keep close tabs on how fast the public project was moving, while the public project had no idea how fast Celera was moving. Under pressure, the project's timeline to completion began to accelerate. Here's David Hausler, the gene-finding computer guy.
The projections for what we needed, how much DNA we had to produce, and what we needed to do with it to assemble it into chromosomes and then analyze those chromosomes, those projections were changing every week as the race just got hotter and hotter.
The three federal centers sequencing DNA had ramped up production spectacularly, but it was clear that assembly was still lagging. And then, as David describes it, in the spring of 2000, Francis Collins delivered some news that changed everything.
Out of the blue, on May 9th, we got on the call with Francis Collins, and he said, well, I have an announcement. I made a deal with Craig Venter.
Francis, the big boss of the Human Genome Project, had agreed to a truce with their arch enemy, Celera, to end all the public acrimony and mudslinging, and to essentially declare a tie ahead of time. Instead of seeing who finished first, Francis told them, the two sides would make a joint announcement at the White House on June 26th, where they would unveil their completed drafts of the genome. The goal was to end the increasingly ugly public battle between the public project and Celera, and hopefully bring a bit of dignity back to this historic achievement. A bit of scientific diplomacy, if you will, that would mean both sides could win. Of course, it also meant that this project that they were originally slated to finish in 5 years now had to be completed in a little over a month. The response, according to David, was shocked silence.
Mic drop at this point. Everyone doing the project, it was like, Francis, you did what? We don't have a genome. We don't have an assembly. We have a huge pile of DNA that is unassembled and no clear plan to assemble it, let alone analyze it.
To David and other members of the project, the decision felt sudden, but it had actually been in the works for weeks, starting with a historic meeting. Francis and Craig have different memories of what prompted the meeting. Here's Craig.
It came about because I knew President Clinton, and he, through a mutual friend, you know, indicated that he wanted to stop all this rancor between NIH and Celera with all the name calling.
Francis, on the other hand, says it was initially his idea, enacted through a neutral third party who was friendly with both sides, a director at the Department of Energy named Ari Petrinos.
And I said, Ari, I think we got to figure out a way to have this acrimony come to an end and turn this into a positive story.
So Ari arranged a meeting between Francis and Craig at his house.
And ordered some pizza, and we went down to Ari's basement and had initially a pretty careful and somewhat uncomfortable conversation about whether there might be a solution here that would bring credit to the project and not just feature the tensions.
It was awkward, of course. Francis says they talked about where each side was, how close to completion, and maybe about each of their goals for the finished genome. Other than that, neither one remembers many details about that night, including what kind of pizza they had.
It was something with tomato sauce. what were the extra fillings on? Was it pepperoni or was it, ham and pineapple? I don't know.
But they did both tell me that the pizza party was just the start of an ongoing conversation that eventually resulted in the decision to do a joint unveiling. The whole point was to ease tensions. Although within each of their own projects, both Craig and Francis faced backlash. Here's Craig.
My decision was very unpopular with my whole team and my closest advisors, some very senior scientists in the community called me and tried to talk me out of it. You know, they wanted me to humiliate Francis Collins and the NIH for the way they were acting. But, you know, as we can see right now, with all the cuts being made to science, the scientific community relies totally on the public trust for funding the breakthroughs to change medicine. And even though there was definitely a part of me that would have loved to publicly announce defeat and humiliate them, I didn't think that was the best thing for public science.
Francis says members of the Human Genome Project felt a similar way.
There was certainly some sense on the team that anything other than complete victory was not what they were looking for. And here is their project leader who's basically agreed to a friendly truce. And there was, at first, some response from some parts of the public project that was surprised and perhaps even a little offended that I had done this unilaterally without consultation.
And, of course, there was the fear that they wouldn't be able to finish in time. It was an absolutely insane deadline. They now had roughly 6 weeks to finish decoding and assembling the human genome. David Hausler, who, remember, was recruited as a gene finder, not an assembler, was in despair. He had been working on a computer program to assemble the pieces, but he wasn't confident that it would work. He updated his coding expert, PhD student Jim Kent, in an email exchange about what was going on. Jim asked how David's assembly program was going, Was the code completely stable? Was David confident he could get it to work and at scale?
And I said, no. And he said, well, you know, I have the makings of a program and it's starting to work. I'm going to go ahead and try to do it faster and better my way. And I said, go ahead. I literally said, Godspeed.
This was it. After 10 years of work by thousands of scientists, billions of dollars in funding, and with the future of genomics research at stake, it had all come down to one eccentric PhD student writing code in his garage.
It was a lot of pressure. I could see that. There was a lot of research that was depending on this.
Luckily, behind the scenes, Jim had been thinking through the problem and had a concept for how to do it. And so, over the next 4 weeks, he set to writing the code for his assembly program, a project that he estimates took at least 12 hours of work per day. Here's David.
I would go over and visit him. He had a cycle of code, nap, code, nap, code, nap. He didn't have a regular sleep cycle, and he would ice his wrists whenever he was not coding because the carpal tunnel would have gotten him otherwise.
I mean, it's true. I would have to ice it. It's not, it's an awkward thing because with a repetitive stress injury, you don't want to overdo it.
It wasn't just Jim working in isolation. Part of the reason he was keeping such odd hours is because he needed to correspond with the sequencing centers, not just in the U.S., but in England, Germany, and Japan.
So once I wrote the Human Genome Browser and could look at the data visually, I was pretty sure that it was okay.
But he needed to test it. So he chose chromosome 18, one of the messier, more complicated chromosomes.
I knew if the browser would work there and if the assembly worked there, I would have been confident of it everywhere.
So Jim ran the program, holding his breath. And suddenly, there it was, chromosome 18 in all its completed glory. He immediately contacted Francis Collins to let him know. From there, the project was engaged in a frantic flurry of last-minute work until they finally finished, on June 22nd, 4 days before the joint announcement with Celera at the White House. And 3 days before Celera finished their draft. The White House ceremony presented it as a tie. But supporters of the public project have insisted that they were the real winners. Craig Venter has his own take.
No, that's total fiction. I don't even know where they get that from. You know, they were struggling. They didn't even know how they were going to put things together. I mean, Jim Kent didn't even do his work until after the White House announcement.
Jim Kent, by the way, says he did complete most of the work before the announcement. And here's what Francis Collins has to say.
I have not heard this particular claim before. If that's the case, it would have been hard to know what Celera's achievement was because they never made the data available. So if he has that evidence, it's never been seen.
In the end, though, the question of who won, in fact, the whole race itself, was kind of academic. In reality, neither side was totally finished. These were drafts of the genome. Most of it was done, but not all of it. There were stretches of DNA that were, as Francis says, so gnarly, so repetitive and stuttering that they couldn't be completed until years later when technology had gotten better. What Francis and Craig do agree on is the impact of decoding the human genome. It changed medicine. It changed science. It changed the world. Here's Craig.
Now, what took me 10 years to do in the lab, any new student can do in about 30 seconds on the computer. So I call it basically the silent revolution because it was so revolutionary. It immediately changed everything, how everything was done, how drug discovery was done, how basic science was done. It elevated the platform. So we started a mile higher than we were before.
What that silent revolution has enabled, Francis says, is staggering advances in cancer research, in the treatment of genetic diseases, in precision medicine, and so much more.
So it's transformative. We crossed the bridge into completely new territory, and we're never going to have to go back again to that. We're the first species that we know of in the universe that's read its own instruction book. And that gives us power and responsibility about what to do about it. And none of that would have happened if we didn't have that initial really hard slog with all those people willing to work on it, to read out those 3 billion letters and to make it all accessible for everybody with a good idea to begin to understand it.
That story was reported by Liz Tong.